You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When a 15-year-old girl from Pakistan's Swat Valley was shot last October, it made international headlines. 36,000 people have been killed in violence in Pakistan over the last 10 years, and Malala Yousafzai had been targeted because she'd spoken out about the violence that had taken over her region as the Taliban asserted its control over it. In her interviews with the international media, Malala put a face on the problems facing girls and women trying to get an education in the middle of the mayhem. Joining me now to discuss how this local schoolgirl went on to global fame is Vanity Fair writer-at-large Marie Brenner. Her article, The Target, appears in the April issue of the magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
Malala Yousafzai's family is from the town of Mingora in the Swat Valley, which has long been a refuge for Taliban fighters and other extremists. What had caused the spike in violence in the federally administered tribal areas in 2007?
Well, it's such a complicated story because the Swat Valley exists as a kind of brigadoon in this frontier region that for years, until the last 20 or 30 years, was run by an extremely enlightened leader who ran it almost like a British principality. And so you have this kind of very enlightened area with free schools and colleges close to Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan, and it's surrounded by the staging area that's used by the military and the Taliban to go in and out of Afghanistan. So it's extremely complicated what happened. But in 2007, as Malala was then about 9 years old, the Taliban began coming back into Mingora in a huge way, in the hills surrounding this town. A radio shock jock just announced, a man called Fazlullah, announced that he was just going to take over the region, and he began blowing up schools in the girls' schools.
Because they're opposed to the education of women?
Absolutely. He wanted Sharia law, you know, the strict Islamic law imposed in the region, and he wanted, they're thugs, and so there was killings, there were the dancers. This is a kind of a beautiful area that had fascinatingly given Pakistan some of its great movie stars who are Pashtuns, and they sing in Pashto, and they had to kind of a Sufi, very Sufi-influenced area. It looks like Switzerland. And so he put a stop to all of this. They began bombing any store that sold DVDs. They began targeting these dancers that entertained at weddings. They stopped all the music festivals. You know, it was as if you were in Afghanistan 20 years ago is essentially what happened.
Well, had the Pakistani government made a much-talked-about effort to push the Taliban out of the Swat Valley and
that
the surrounding
came
areas?
That came later. That came about 2009, and it took months, and it was really pretty ineffective until the Taliban advanced on Islamabad, only 100 miles away. But, you know, you have to see this, I think, as a kind of that Malala and her father and their school, they were so enlightened, and they are very educated, and they are in a tradition of poetry and literature. And this school that Ziauddin Yousafzai owns and runs, he has two actually, one for boys and one for girls, this is a sort of an oasis of enlightenment in a war zone. So, you know, these are people who are highly educated, who are caught up in a desperate circumstance.
Well, Ziauddin had been a teenager when the area became a training ground for the Taliban. Taliban means student in Pashto. Was the Swat Valley where their madrasas had been located?
Yes, because they were using them as a training area for the jihadists going in to fight against, you know, to fight in Afghanistan when the Soviets invaded. And one of the most fascinating things for me, Leonard, was understanding who Ziauddin Yousafzai, Malala's extraordinary father, was and is. I mean, just imagine this, that he's growing up in this very enlightened education system, reading all the great poets, understanding literature, run almost in, you know, again, like a British principality. And suddenly this Islamic this extraordinary Islamic fanaticism begins to take over Pakistan in the form of General Zia, who imposes Islamic studies in the schools. And even his local teacher, you know, who was teaching him the Quran, because this is a very, you know, this is a very devoted man, begins encouraging him as a teenager to fight the jihad. And he said that this gave him nightmares for years, and he was as a teenager, because it just went against everything he believed. And going to college saved him. And he resolved that if when he got out that he would just start schools and do everything possible to keep the enlightenment going in the area. No, he's an extraordinary figure. He was a great student leader. He was the president of a political union at his college. He's a very much a free thinker.
And people pay to go to these schools? The parents pay
almost
for
almost free. The tuition is absolutely negligible. But we're not talking about people with means. I mean, Ziauddin, I believe, comes from the sort of the working middle class. His father owns a small farm up in the hills near Mingora. But one of his friends told me that when he was going to the local college, he literally, you know, he lived with a friend to save money to even be able to afford the small tuition. As I was working on it, I was sort of reminded of one of the great characters in Chekhov, you know, one of the 19th century teachers in an isolated part of Russia, who is the man of the profound enlightenment who tries to change his community.
He had spent years trying to get the word out to reporters about the situation in the Swat Valley, and Pakistan's reporters weren't picking up the story in the summer of 2007. Later, local officials also became more and more reluctant to speak on the record to reporters. Was he being very brave?
Very brave. And Peshawar is a several-hour drive away. Peshawar is right on the border, and it's the capital of this particular province. So just to imagine Peshawar in this time, you know, this is where Osama bin Laden started. It's where they trade the Kalashnikovs in the markets. We've all seen and read so much about it. And Ziauddin would go to the local press club and try to engage whoever he could meet to alert them what was happening in Mingora. But Mingora was not where the big action is. You know, imagine this is an entire frontier region. And you had reporters coming in from the west then. Peshawar was a kind of a boom town for the local press, trying to understand the 20 or 30 Taliban groups that regularly went in and out on the border. It was Waziristan, north and south, is what where the big problems were then. So Ziauddin was trying so hard to alert people about what was happening to his beautiful town of Mingora.
My guest is Marie Brenner, who's written an article about Malala Yousafzai and her father and the situation in the Swat Valley for the current issue of Vanity Fair. How did people first meet Malala? What did she say in that first news report?
Well, this so interested me. There was a reporter working for Dawn TV. The TV was exploding then in Pakistan. It had just become deregulated, and there were all kinds of cable stations opening. Dawn, which is the largest English-language newspaper in Pakistan, had just started, and a former professor, they were recruiting any young reporter, professor, expert they could possibly find to do a kind of a stand-up on these regions to go on TV. So a very, very smart young professor named Irfan Ashraf had just been hired, and he was walking by his boss's desk, who was editing just a kind of a three-minute soundbite he had just done in Mingora in this school, the Khatak school that Ziauddin owns. And he sees this little girl, this extraordinary 9-year-old girl, speaking in a kind of ultra-refined Urdu. And he was shocked, you know, because this is a very traditional area, and it's very unusual for children and girls to speak out in this area. And suddenly he sees this amazing face, and he couldn't get her face and her gaze out of his mind.
She also spoke English, didn't she?
She spoke, yes, she did speak English, but this was, she was speaking in Urdu at this moment because the area, it's a three-language area, and they then translated it into English for the broadcast. And he just resolved, I must, you know, he was going back and forth from the region. There were so many explosions, and the Taliban was all over the place, blowing up things in this area that's probably the size of Delaware. So he was so busy that he just thought, the next time I'm in Mingora, I must find my way to the school and meet this child, who was then nine, and you know, just a fourth grader, so in a classroom. So when this, she led the news that night, which was, again, very unusual for a rural area. It's not, these rural areas are not seen in Pakistan by the elites. So quite extraordinarily, his boss got a phone call from the owner of the school, and he said, this little girl you put on your sound, your news, this is my daughter. And that's really how it began.
In November of that year, November 2007, the Red Mosque in Islamabad was bombed. It's not far from the ISI's headquarters. The following month, Benazir Bhutto was assassinated during her campaign for prime minister. Was that when the violence started to escalate in the tribal areas as well?
There was a long period. The Red Mosque was invaded and blew up in the summer of 2007, Leonard. And so you just imagine Pakistan is going into chaos. I mean, the ISI headquarters is, the Red Mosque in Islamabad is, was a place traditionally that a lot of extremists went to. And it is literally, apparently, you know, within about a 10-minute walk of the ferocious ISI headquarters. So, you know, all of these groups, they exist with very dusty, murky alliances, all helping each other. And when the Red Mosque blew, Pakistan, that was really, you know, that was really sort of another tipping point. 7 or 8 months later, Benazir Bhutto came back, was met by millions of fans cheering her. And the hyper-nationalists, this kind of very strong group in Pakistan politically, who knows what happened? You never really know for sure what, who's doing what in Pakistan. But she was assassinated. And after that, Pakistan kind of went into a long period of real chaos, hundreds and hundreds of explosions and bombings everywhere.
And more girls started coming to Ziauddin's school because theirs had been destroyed by the Taliban.
Imagine, they blew up 200 schools.
And they blew them up at night, right?
Yes.
Why at night?
Well, there's a very sacred, one of the astonishing aspects of this story is children are never, rarely attacked, although since just before Malala was attacked, there have been, you know, the blasphemers and these girls who are accused falsely of blasphemy. There's a very strong tradition in Islam and in the Pashtun tribe that children are not, are sacred, and you're just, they cannot be attacked. So no one was going to blow up a school during the day because of this.
Marie Brenner is my guest. Her article in Vanity Fair is called The Target. It's in the April issue of Vanity Fair. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in the show, Richard Hell talks about starting pivotal punk bands like Television, The Heartbreakers, and Richard Hell and the Voidoids. And then in our second hour, Jonathan Dee talks about his latest novel, A Thousand Pardons, which explores public scandal and how and when we ask for forgiveness. I'd also like to alert you to the fact that I'll be hosting a 40 and over singles event on Tuesday, March 19th. I hope you can join us at Hudson Terrace for speed dating at 6, followed at 8, with a chance to casually mingle with other WNYC listeners while you enjoy a drink and light snacks on the house. For more information and tickets, go to WNYC.org/events. And I hope to see you there. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. You can catch up with the show on both Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC support comes from Adelphi University, helping students daily to make the transition from the classroom to a career, with over 100,000 Adelphi alumni in the workforce throughout the world. More at adelphi.edu/success. Penguin Books, publisher of Reading for My Life by John Leonard, featuring a foreword by E.L. Doctorow, This career-spanning collection includes the longtime critics' reviews of authors such as Philip Roth, Joan Didion, Vladimir Nabokov, and more, now available wherever books are sold. LV Wood Floors, specializing in custom pre-finished wood flooring and reclaimed wood flooring made to the client's specifications, all sustainably made in the USA. The New York City showroom on 20th Street between 5th and 6th Avenue is open to the public. LVWoodFloors.com.
10 years after the U.S. invaded Iraq, the struggle to tell that story.
I fell into literature because that can be the most effective way to communicate the complexities of any war, especially something as complicated as the Iraq War.
A former soldier, one of the voices, all next week on Iraq, 10 years on. Civilians in Baghdad to American veterans all recovering. From what? Remembering. Next time on The Takeaway. This afternoon at 3 on 93.9 FM WNYC.
We're reading F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby for the London Low-Paid Show Book Club and teaming up with the BBC's World Book Club, so it will be heard worldwide. And you can join in the discussion Friday, March 22nd during a live event in the Green Space when Jay McInerney will be our guest. So pick up a copy of Fitzgerald's classic account of the Roaring Twenties and make a point to stop by. RSVP to the event on our show page at WNYC.org. We're back with Marie Brenner, who has written about Malala Yousafzai in the current issue of Vanity Fair, the April issue of the magazine. But you're in San Diego right now?
Absolutely.
You're not covering this story.
No, just I'm in San Diego enjoying the sunshine.
Now, getting back to the story, when the local Taliban leader Maulana Fazlullah announced that the remaining girls' schools would be closed in January 2009. International news outlets scrambled to cover it, that story. Where did the idea of a web video for the New York Times come from? And how did they find Malala as the person to do it?
Well, it's again, and a kind of amazing story that there wasn't an international scramble. There were about three reporters, one who was reporting for the BBC, the Pashto News Service, the BBC. And just a few reporters were there. They were desperate. They didn't know how to get this story out. And so what had happened is the years of all of these explosions and chaos had created a tiny band of journalists who, with Ziauddin Yousafzai, were really acting like partisans. You have to think of it almost like a town in France in 1941, a resistance cell. And that's really what, for me, was so interesting about this, that these anyone who was trying to do anything to get international attention would find their way to Ziauddin Yousafzai's school, which is, in fact, named after a poet who was a famous resistor poet of the 18th century in Pakistan. So you had, again, this tiny little enclave of this fiercely brave band of intellectuals who were there trying desperately to get attention. And two of them, one of them was working part-time while he worked at Dawn TV, Irfan Ashraf, as a fixer for the New York Times. And so he got the idea of Adam Elick was working then in Islamabad. You couldn't get into the region if you were a foreign reporter. The Taliban was just everywhere. And he got this idea to do the school situation. And there were lots of discussions about this inside the New York Times, I understand, because it's a very, everyone knew the danger. You know, this is not a decision that was taken lightly. And at the same time, the BBC man, Hai Kakar, got the idea because, again, they wanted someone who could carry the story to have a girl from Ziauddin Yousafzai's school blog under an assumed name, because anyone who spoke out would be immediately killed. And he went to Ziauddin and asked for one of the girls to do it. No one would do it because of the danger. And finally, Ziauddin, as we many of us, you know, has been well reported now, said, "What about my daughter? She's young, but I think she can do it."
Although everybody was aware of just how dangerous this whole thing might have been.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Now, didn't Ashraf say that Malala was ordinary in person but extraordinary on camera? What made her so compelling on screen?
This is when she was nine. Mm-hmm. So when he first saw her as a small child, just imagine, you know, a shy schoolgirl. This is Pakistan, and this is this region. It's a very traditional area. She had a captivating way of being crystal clear in what she said when she just burst out from, her classroom in Mingora. You know, the Taliban are a danger to us, and we're not allowed to get an education, and the bombs are keeping us up at night. I mean, for the West, this seems like, you know, a rather, you know, just a commonplace thing a nine-year-old might say. But again, for the region, it was very unusual.
And did she also criticize the army in blogs that she did for the BBC?
Yes, that comes later. Yes, by this time she's 11 now when she starts blogging. And every night, the process of it, Kakar got a separate phone line because, again, there were so many traces from the army, the Taliban. The level of danger was very well known by everyone involved.
He had a separate
phone line that couldn't be traced.
Did they think that because she was still a child, she might be less likely to be attacked?
Yes, that's what they thought.
And in every interview, she used an assumed name, but they might have been able to figure out her identity pretty easily.
Well, it's not a big place. And, you know, again, Ziauddin Yousafzai was the local activist. He was the leader of what they call the Jirga, the Council of Town Elders. He was the most active spokesperson. And he has this wonderful, exuberant optimism, this extraordinary belief that everything has to be peaceful descent. He would never get into negativity. And so he just believes, and he's very philosophical, he just believes that he can save his region by the force of what he knows and understands. A very, very unusual man.
The New York Times shot a second video, this time including Ziauddin Yousafzai and a meeting that both of them had with Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. Special Envoy at the time. Why was Ashraf particularly concerned when he saw the final edit of that second video?
Well, this happened over an 8-month period, and it's been implied in a lot of the stories that Ziauddin, from the first moment, had no ambivalence about putting his daughter forward. Nothing could be further from the truth. At the first moment in the middle of shelling, when Ashraf goes into Mingora with a Times cameraman to show up at the school, it was very clear that his assignment was something that he didn't clearly understand. He was told by the Times and by Adam Elick to shoot everything, that this was going to be narrative journalism. But narrative journalism, which is an intimate form of, you know, showing everything and private emotions, is really not done in India or Pakistan and in South Asia. It's a very unusual form of journalism for that region. And so when he appeared at the school with his cameras on the last day before the Taliban shut the schools down, Ziauddin, the father, was horrified when he came early in the morning, and he asked him to leave. He didn't want him to be there. He didn't want Malala shot. He didn't want her on camera. And it was raises so many interesting questions about the nature of reporting in a war zone. What are the dangers of exposure? You know, what do you do? You have an assignment. This was a big break for Ashraf to get this assignment from the New York Times. So it's a very complex story. It's sort of an accidental set of dramatic circumstances.
And Syed Irfan Ashraf has written something of a mea culpa, hasn't he, apologizing
yes.
for starting what he called the hype surrounding Malala?
That's right, the anguish. And he feels very responsible for then the cascading events that happened. He feels heartsick about it.
Was she receiving threats as a result of the blog and the New York Times stories?
No one knew who she was for a long, you know, the Times and the blog, she was really, again, pretty anonymous. But as the Taliban cleared out, it began became an open secret. And she began getting award after award and speaking out then openly, because the drama takes place over several years. So she gets photographed with various leaders. She wins runner-up on an international peace prize. And for each one of this, a rural child, again, she's coming from a closed society. A rural child is speaking out for education, for the desperate need for education. And in a closed society, she did not mince words.
Well, her father had been speaking out for years. Had he been a target?
Absolutely. He said to me on the telephone, I spoke with him briefly, he said that three times a day people would tell him, Ziauddin, you're going to get killed. He said, I didn't care. You know, it's too important. He's, again, a fierce activist. But for me, one of the most interesting parts and just inspiring is this is really the story of a father and a daughter. Malala was the firstborn in this family. And, you know, Ziauddin said, she was, from the moment she was born, she was my little spark plug. And he had her in every classroom. They lived in a two-room apartment in the school. Again, you know, this is not an upper-middle-class family by any means. And she would just have the run of all these classrooms, a two-year-old running around just getting everything. And it was so clear to everyone in the school, her teachers, her principal, how gifted she was from the moment she was born. She was winning debating contests in the fifth grade. You know, this is a very unusual girl.
Now
the father had her with him at all times. He just dotes on her.
She was shot this October on her school bus.
Yes.
Why did people think the military was involved in the shooting?
Well, the military uses the Taliban a lot of the military. Again, this is dusty cells. You don't know who's doing it. You don't know where it's coming from. But these are the Taliban, in large part, have come back from Afghanistan now. They were trained to go in, and they are all over the place. And the military uses them to destabilize Afghanistan. They go back and forth. And so you very rarely get an arrest. Now the government is trying to take action because the situation has again gotten out of hand. They thought they had calmed it down. They haven't. So now apparently they're trying to take some action again.
Fazlullah's group took credit for the attack with a 7-page statement. Was there any acknowledgement that they had just gone against tradition in targeting a 15-year-old girl?
They said that she was now that 15, she was no longer a child. Very good, you know, very good question. And then they accused her of things like being a Zionist spy because she had once greeted the late special envoy Richard Holbrooke at a meeting.
And he was a Zionist?
Yes. And that she was a CIA operative, that she had worn makeup on a show on the BBC, and so, of course, that made her an infidel and a kafir, they said. So 7 pages of it. And then they said if she came back, they would kill the father as well. Many people in the progressive political circles of Pakistan, this situation has caused more outrage than anything in years. And it's easy to understand why. It's just like, again, Malala seems to many people in Pakistan to be part of a group like the late Salman Taseer, the governor of Punjab, who was assassinated, and his lawyers were throwing rose petals at the assassin. These are all people who are trying to speak out in pluralistic Pakistan for the fight against the strict Islamists that are taking over and the failure of the government to stop it, the failure of the army.
So what happened after Malala was shot? Was she taken immediately to a hospital?
Yes, and she was taken immediately to a hospital in Peshawar, and she was so, because again, she had become a figure of the local media and the international media in a small way. So there was an immediate outpouring around the world that just shocked the powers in Pakistan. And it was said by many, you know, this was Malala's story showed that not only was there absolutely no protection, but that the army was not in control, the Taliban had come back, that their operation had not been effective. And the general, the most powerful man in Pakistan's military, which is by definition, the most powerful man in Pakistan, General Kayani, immediately the next day flew to Peshawar to be at her bedside. And that caused so many questions for people in Pakistan. You know, he didn't show up when the 15-year-old who was accused of blasphemy was harmed. No one, he had never shown up before. And many people said, what is this about? It was, what? Why?
So where is Malala Yousafzai now?
At the moment, she's in Birmingham, England. She was flown there. She is recovering. She's doing remarkably well, people say. She's planning to do a book about her life, and she's an astonishing young woman. Destiny, she stood up. Destiny picked her out of anonymity.
Well, can she return to Mingora?
I don't think she can return to Mingora anytime soon, but there are many people who say that she will be such a force for the global education, the need to educate girls, to the fight against extremism, the fight against chaos. Anything could happen now to Malala in the future. She could become her father always wanted her to go into politics, and you can see that in her future. If she recovers sufficiently, you can absolutely see her going back to her country when she's through college and becoming a real force for change in Pakistan.
And what's happened to her father's school?
Her father's school is still operating. The girls there were two other girls injured with her. They've all spoken out very forcefully for Malala, but there's a lot of terror in the region. There's been attacks of all kinds. Mosques have been blown up. A school that was named after Malala, just after she was injured, was attacked. So the Swat Valley is reacting. Their people have pulled in fear.
Vanity Fair writer-at-large Marie Brenner's article, The Target, appears in the April issue of that magazine. Marie, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you, Leonard.